Mr. Hochstetler, please proceed. Wait a sec, let him... Just give a sec. Okay, please proceed.
It was obvious to lower the dose of the testosterone drug that it overdosed patients in three published clinical studies. That, in essence, is our argument. There was no dispute that the drug used in the clinical studies was the composition recited in the asserted claims. The district court clearly erred in failing to find from the stipulated fact that the articles that described the clinical studies also inherently described the recited composition.
But inherent disclosure requires that something necessarily be true, and the testimony in this case was that any of a large number of co-solvents could have been used and that the ratios could have been different. It turns out that what they actually used in those studies did correspond to the claims, but that's not what the references disclose, and quite frankly, nor do they inherently disclose that under our law of inherency.
Your Honor, I don't agree. The fact that there is no dispute that the composition was in fact used.
That doesn't mean it's inherently disclosed. I don't understand how you want to mess up the law of anticipation and inherency. It's a straightforward, it's never been articulated any differently than the document necessarily includes that. And in this case, you can't say this document necessarily includes it. It turns out that study did in fact include it, but the testimony of record was that any number, I believe it's five different co-solvents would have worked and different ratios would have worked, and all the experts agreed on that. So I don't understand how we would mess up the law of inherency, which is what you're asking us to do, by concluding that even though the document doesn't necessarily result in someone understanding that this is what was used, it should nonetheless be deemed to be inherently disclosed.
Your Honor, I don't believe anywhere in the record does it say that another combination would have obtained exactly the same combination of pharmacokinetic profile and the results. The testimony was that there were other solvents that could be used. But the in this case, though, people of skill today recognize that what was used in those studies was necessarily the recited.
It is what was used, but at A404, they point out that Custopharm's expert conceded APOSA would not know that the prior art necessarily used a formula of 40% castor oil and 60% benzyl benzoate, and that is pointing to the expert testimony at A404. So in addition to the fact that there were at least five co-solvents that could have been used, of which only one was benzobenzoate, they've got evidence they point to that would support the fact-finding the district court made in this case.
But, Your Honor, that goes to the recognition requirement, and there is no requirement that persons of ordinary skill recognized at the time what the composition was, and that testimony, I believe, was directed to that.
Okay, so let me see if I can understand. There might be two strains of inherency that we're discussing right now. One is the one that I understand that Judge Moore is questioning you about, which is when someone's reading those articles, a person of ordinary skill in the art, even though the articles don't expressly say benzyl benzoate and a ratio of 40 to 60 between castor oil and benzyl benzoate, nevertheless, a person of skill would necessarily understand while reading that reference in context, aha, there's definitely benzyl benzoate in here and it's at a 40 to 60 ratio. And that strain of inherency, you agree, is not what you're advancing. Is that fair to say? It's a different strain, which is that the actual formulation that was being used by those authors in those articles was necessarily the very formulation that's being recited in these claims. And so even though it could not be appreciated by a person of ordinary skill in the art reading those articles at the time, they were somehow inherently a necessary characteristic of the formulation that was being reported on in those articles. Is that your theme of your inherency argument?
As I understand it, Your Honor, those two inherency themes, as you put it, actually come together. In Continental Can,
tell me what Continental Can is, I want you to tell me what your particular theory of inherency is. Did I get it right or did I get it wrong?
You got it slightly wrong, Your Honor.
Okay.
Inherency does require a person of ordinary skill to recognize that the disclosure necessarily encompassed the invention. However, in the Shearing case, established that recognition does not have to occur during the prior art period. Today, a person of ordinary skill reading the articles knows that the composition is the recited composition. So those two issues, as we see it, come together. And the key is that the recognition of the necessary result does not have to occur during the prior art period.
But I guess the concern I have about your argument is that what was disclosed in those articles was an incomplete disclosure of what that formulation was. It gave you some of the ingredients, but it didn't give you all the ingredients. It's almost like the article had said, we have this interesting new formulation for administering testosterone, and we've come up with this really special vehicle for administering it, but I'm not going to tell you what my secret vehicle is. And now I'm just going to report out the favorable results that I have from my secret vehicle. Do you think that would put the invented vehicle in the possession of the public once an article like that was published?
It would put it into the possession of the public once the public recognized the inherent disclosure. Again, this court, I believe, has rejected on several occasions the idea that the recognition had to be had to occur during the prior art period.
I guess I'm worried that if there is some kind of formulation with five ingredients, but let's say the author only chooses to identify one of the five ingredients and says, I'm not going to tell you the other four, and no one reading the article would be able to figure out what those other four are, I don't know if we can say that five-ingredient formulation was actually disclosed and taught in that prior art reference.
Let me follow up on Judge Chen's hypothetical, because I think it's very useful. Your argument is effectively, when 20 years later the formula for Coke does get known, it's obvious based on this article, even though it wasn't disclosed, and it's obvious as of that date earlier, even though people didn't know it. That's your problem. Your problem isn't that you want to use the information once it became known as of the date it became known. You want to use the information and give it the date of the articles for prior art purposes, for obviousness.
Well, what we want to say is that a publication is a dedication to the public of all that's contained therein. And if the public learns later something new about that disclosure, that information is not taken away.
But it wasn't contained therein. That's your problem. The information wasn't contained therein. It wasn't. The public didn't become in possession of that information until later in time.
Your Honor,
it doesn't necessarily get contained therein. So the kinds of cases you're talking about, where it's even if the public doesn't know about it, is where there is a natural physiological response that will always happen to a particular drug. It may be people didn't know about it at the time, but it always happens. So once we learn that it always happens, that disclosure necessarily included it because nothing else could have resulted in that. But here, any number of different co-solvents could have resulted in what the article reported. We just found out later what they actually used, but any number of them could have. It's not necessarily the case that it had to be these.
Now, as we pointed out in our blue brief, in the Atlas Powder case, that necessarily resulted, the practice of the prior art reference didn't necessarily result in the claimed invention. It depended on how you practiced it, and there was no recognition of that. And so the logic of those cases, Your Honor, we submit actually counsels in favor of saying that the when it's here, there's no question that, in fact, what is disclosed in the articles was the recited composition. Then the public is in possession of that information, and if they learn more about it later, then the public's entitled.
But I guess you would agree that at the time those articles were published, there was not enough information in those articles for someone else, a person of skill in the art, to go out and make and use that formulation. Is that fair to say?
No, I wouldn't agree that not to make and use the formulation. They would not, however, have known.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you agree or disagree with me? At the time of those articles' publication, a person of skill in the art would not be able to make and use the claimed formulation in the sense that they would know, aha, I'm going to use benzyl benzoate. I'm going to use a ratio of castor oil to benzyl benzoate of 40 to 60.
The testimony was that a person of ordinary skill would not have known immediately what the combination was, that it would have been a matter of routine experimentation to get to the 40-60 combination because that was a commercial product. I see him into my rebuttal time.
Okay. Let's save your rebuttal time. Mr. Gortz.
May it please the court, Nevin Gewertz on behalf of Bayer and Indo Pharmaceuticals. The patents at issue claim a novel dose regimen and formulation of testosterone undecanoate that work in combination to provide long-acting serum testosterone levels in a broad population of hypogonadal men. The prior art does not contain the claimed 750 milligram dose, the claimed 4-week followed by a subsequent 10-week injection interval regimen, or the 40% castor oil, 60% benzyl benzoate formulation, let alone any of the three in combination with one another.
Tell us what your views are on the inherency question that discussing with your opposing counsel.
Absolutely. And I think actually, Your Honor, Judge Chen's hypothetical that he posed to my friend is fitting and was one that was similarly used at the trial court level. And I'd like to elaborate and give an example. If the prior art included a letter for, hypothetically, from Dean Kamen that said, I'm about to come out with an invention, it has a handlebar, two wheels, and goes really fast, and then subsequently claimed in a subsequent patent the Segway, that prior art would not inherently anticipate the Segway because it allows for both a bicycle to be described and a Segway. And the same issue is here, where the prior art describes the formulation as, and I would just quote, 250 milligrams testosterone undecanoate dissolved in 1 milliliter castor oil. And that's at Appendix 1125. That description, that teaching in the prior art, allows for any number of formulations that contain benzyl benzoate or other co-solvents at various different ratios. So to the Segway example, where the prior art describes a situation that allows for many different possibilities. This court's cases specifically state, and I would quote from In re Ricard, that what may be present is not necessarily known, and obviousness cannot be predicated on what may not necessarily be known.
But it is true that the formulation that was being discussed by the authors of those articles, it was, in fact, it did have benzyl benzoate and a 40-60 ratio. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so in that sense, we could say that an inherent characteristic of the composition being discussed in those articles were those particular features. And so what I'm wondering is there are cases of our court, like In re Krish, where there's, in the prior art, a disclosed gene. And then later on, someone else goes through all the effort and work of discovering an inherent characteristic of that gene, the promoter region. Sure. And then we said, well, nobody knew about the details of that promoter region. Nevertheless, it was an inherent characteristic of that prior art structure. So then, therefore, it's just there's no patentability here.
Absolutely.
And so that's the struggle here in trying to understand how this fits within that kind of case law.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if you'll allow me, I think both the In Re Krish and the Atlas Powder cases are sort of prescient on this point. As you noted, in Krish, it was the promoter region of the human involucrin gene. And in Atlas Powder, the inherent characteristic, as you put it, was the presence of interstitial air in the ammonium nitrate. And in Atlas Powder, we had a formulation in the prior art containing ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. And what was at issue there is the inherency of air within ammonium nitrate itself, such as here, if the claim in the patent was to castor oil that contained, let's say, 1% water content. And the evidence at trial was that castor oil necessarily, 100% of the time, had 1% water content, that would be inherent. But that's not what the claims in these patents state. We're talking about benzyl benzoate, a second ingredient in the formulation. And the testimony at trial was that the person of skill would have a choice among co-solvents.
Are you going to get to the facts of Krish pretty soon?
Sure. Krish dealing with the promoter region in the human involucrin gene, that promoter region is present. The DNA sequence to that region is present 100% of the time. In the prior art, the gene itself was in the prior art. The record demonstrated the size of the promoter region and the plasmid of origin. And this court in that case said, even understanding that other practitioners, other skilled artisans, had tried to sequence it and come up with a different event, we know that the promoter region in Krish, 100% of the time, has that particular DNA sequence. Here, it is not true that practicing the prior art 100% of the time yields a 40% castor oil, 60% benzyl benzoate ratio. In fact, the only evidence that Custa Farm has put forward in the trial court level of that inherency was a stipulation that as of 2007, 4 years after the critical date, that in fact the ratio had that particular formulation. I think another way to consider this problem is the idea of whether or not the use of this particular formulation in the prior art was invalidating is tantamount to a public use argument. That argument was not made at the trial court level, and in any event, would not be relevant here because the particular clinical studies at issue.
Do we have a different legal standard for understanding public use and on-sale bar compared to what needs to be disclosed in a prior art reference for purposes of 102? And let me explain what I'm getting at.
Sure.
It seems like our law on public use and on-sale bar, as long as the product is in use or on sale, you don't have to disclose all the little details of that product, and it'll still be an invalidating act. Whereas for prior art references, we don't seem to have that kind of a flexible standard. We require every itty-bitty claim element to actually be disclosed or necessarily be inherently disclosed in some way. Do you understand the question I'm getting at?
I'll try, if you will. But as I understand it, there are differences between the 102 doctrines of this court and 103. The obviousness analysis here relying on the teaching of the prior art and what a person of skill would understand.
Right. I'm talking about prior art publications versus public use acts.
And in the inherency,
they're both part of Section 102, and yet for prior art references, I take it you're advancing the idea that even if the product is being discussed and disclosed, you still need to actually describe all the claim elements for it to be an invalidating reference, unlike a public use.
Or that those claim elements would be necessarily present 100% of the time. I think if you look at the inherency cases of this court, there is this idea of if practicing the prior art would necessarily be practicing the subsequent claimed invention. And that's where I think you get some of the marriage between the doctrines that you see. But in this case, the actual testimony, the record evidence upon which the district court made its factual findings is that there were possibilities to practice the prior art, practice that 250 milligrams TU in castor oil. That could be practiced a number of different ways with a number of different co-solvents at a number of different ratios. And it is that nature of the practice of the prior art, including many different formulations other than those claimed, that is why the inherency doctrine has no place in this case.
Apart from the inherency doctrine, I don't understand the fact finding that it would not have been obvious or there wouldn't have been a motivation to lower the testosterone from 1,000 milligrams to 750 milligrams in light of the evidence of record that studies done with 1,000 milligrams showed that subjects were above what the ACEE rated as healthy and normal in light of the dosage.
Sure. And
did I get all those facts right, by the way?
I'll slightly alter some of those facts, which is first that the three prior art studies show mean serum testosterone level. The mean serum testosterone level in each of the three studies after the initial dose at 1,000 milligrams is within both the AACE guidelines as well as all other normal guidelines.
Well, the mean, but that's the mean. And there were some subjects in the study that were above the healthy dose guidelines.
There was, in the prior art itself, there is only record of a single anomaly subject at 40.8 serum testosterone level after the first dose. The other evidence is not in the prior art. And if you look at footnote 20 of the district court's opinion, the court notes that that evidence is not in the prior art and would not be considered. There was also testimony at the trial court level that such a level slightly above the normal range would not cause a concern for a clinician because the prior testosterone treatments that were in the prior art, these are other testosterone esters, it was common for serum testosterone levels to fluctuate several fold greater than the normal range. This is at appendix 1161, and the district court finding at appendix 32 regards that this would not cause a concern to a clinician. Moreover, we look at the conclusions of the prior articles themselves, which do not address any sort of safety concern and do not suggest any overdose. In fact, they suggest the contrary and state at appendix 1129 that the serum testosterone levels does not result in supranormal serum testosterone levels above the normal range. And inherent in the, not inherent, but in the overdose theory that is being put forward is, as the district court notes, the idea of the AACE guidelines. The evidence at trial is that the AACE guidelines were one of many different normal ranges that were present at the time. Custopharm's own expert admitted in a book that was edited and published contemporaneous with the critical date here that of all the guideline ranges and the normal ranges at the time, the 10 to 35 nanomole per liter range was the most common used by clinicians. And it is within that range that understand.
You said that there was only, I want to make sure I understand the facts right, only one subject who was above, is it the ACEE 10 to 30 range? Is there only one subject above that range?
The both normal ranges.
AACE.
I'm not sure which one it is. But in the Barre article, which starts at appendix 1125, there is the mention of a single outlier patient.
Yes, go ahead.
And it is above both the AACE guidelines as well as what would have been the other normal ranges, including those adopted.
Are there other patients who are reported to be above the AACE guidelines in those articles?
Not in the prior art, unless you extrapolate from standard deviations, meaning that if you take two standard deviations away from the mean, you could extrapolate that there might be. But there is no evidence in the prior art itself other than for that one patient of other individuals who were actually outside of the prior art range.
What about Proliton? Why, that was a known vehicle of administering a drug. So why not use testosterone with any known vehicle? And Proliton's one of them.
Sure. And Your Honor, we don't dispute that Proliton may have been one of the sort of things on the tool shed of the inventor. But the point here is that whether or not the district court's finding that there would be no motivation to use the formulation of Proliton, given that it was a short-acting injectable, was not a formulation with a testosterone ester or testosterone of any type, that the person of skill would not be motivated to combine Proluton, which is in the Pushpalatha reference, with the other prior art articles, when in fact there were other prior art articles that included both testosterone esters in castor oil, and those articles show that the amount of castor oil was greater than 60% in order to achieve the potential long-acting objective that was put forward in these patents. And those can be found at Appendix 1154, 1622, and 1637. That's the Humpel, the 791 patent reference, and European patent reference 794. Those are the examples of formulations with castor oil and other testosterone esters with a different formulation than that claimed.
Did Judge Robinson point to those?
They are indirectly referenced because she references the testimony about those in the record.
Do you have anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay. We have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Shen, Enri Krish is the case that we contend supports our inherency position. In Enri Krish, the prior art did not know what the promoter sequence was, and in a prior art attempt to sequence it failed. So the sequence didn't necessarily result from the practice of the prior art, and yet this court still found inherency. Judge Moore, AACE was one of two standards. It was the expert standard, but it was the less common standard. There weren't multiple, there were two. And in both Bera and in Nischlag, there were patients who were overdosed by the AACE standards. With respect to Proluton Depot, the motivation, as we explained in our briefs, to use that was separate and apart from whether or not you were looking for a long-acting injectable. It was also desirable to have a concentrated steroid injectable drug, and Proluton Depot was the only 250 milligram per milliliter injectable drug on the market. It was desirable to use a commercial product because you had no FDA issues, and that would have been a separate motivation to try the Proluton Depot. And we know it would have worked because the claimed invention, the composition, is simply testosterone and decanoate substituted for the exact same vehicle. Opposing counsel used an example that I didn't quite follow, but he said if castor oil inherently contained 1% water, then that would that he thought would be an example of inherency. But in Atlas powder, if we follow that, it would have been that inherently, castor oil could have anywhere from 1 to 10% water. And in Atlas powder, the fact that one of those ranges, in fact, would produce the claimed invention was found to make it inherent. Those are the only points I had in rebuttal unless the court has any other questions.
Okay, great. Thank both counsel for their argument. The case is taken under submission.